Hello and welcome to the American Writers Museum Author Talks podcast, where we bring the power of the written word straight to your ears. This week, best-selling author Sudhir Venkatesh discusses his new book, The Tomorrow Game, Rival Teenagers, Their Race for a Gun, and a Community United to Save Them. This conversation originally took place July 6th, 2022, and was recorded live at the American Writers Museum. We hope you enjoy entering the mind of a writer.
Welcome to the American Writers Museum and to this author event. Thank you all for being here tonight. My name is Allison Sansoni. I'm the program director here at the museum. Tonight's program is offered in conjunction with our upcoming exhibit, Dark Testament, which opens in September and focuses on writers for justice between the end of the Civil War and the beginning of the Civil Rights Movement. The Tomorrow Game is based on Sudhir Venkatesh's three decades of immersion in Chicago's South Side and looks at the toll that poverty and gun violence take on families and on their communities. At the heart of this story are two teenagers, Marshall Marriott, an introverted video gamer and bike rider, and Frankie Paul, who leaves foster care to direct his cousin's drug business while he's in prison. Frankie devises a plan to attack Marshall and his friends. Catching wind of the plan, Marshall and his friends decide they must preemptively go after Frankie's crew to defend their honor. The pressure mounts as both groups of teens race to find a gun and strike first. All the while, the community at large, a cast that includes the teens' families, black market drug dealers, local pastors, a bodega owner, and a veteran beat cop, try their best to defuse the conflict and keep the kids alive. Sudhir is the author of Floating City and Gang Leader for a Day, a New York Times bestseller that received a Best Book of the Year award from The Economist. He's been a Columbia University professor, a director of safety teams at Facebook and Twitter, and a senior advisor to the Department of Justice. His writings have appeared in the New York Times, the Chicago Tribune, and the Washington Post, and he lives in New York City. He's here to discuss The Tomorrow Game with Tenny Gross, Executive Director of the Institute for Nonviolence Chicago. Please join me in welcoming them both.
Good evening, everybody. Thank you all for coming out. I feel very blessed to be able to see all of you and to be in a room and see anyone in person these days, so it feels great. Tenny and I are gonna have a conversation, and then we'll all hopefully have a conversation. That's the run of show for tonight. And I think we're gonna start with, either Tenny's gonna start with a question or I'm gonna start with a reading, but what do you want, Tenny? What should we do?
Start with a question.
Start with a question, okay.
So, unlike some other books that on the topic we all care about, which is violence prevention, this feels, I told you when we talked, it feels like chamber music. You said more like a little piece of jazz. And I believe sometimes the deepest things are the ones that are actually contained and minor. They're not trying to be loud. Our society has a lot of loud voices now, but this one is really sort of a small play with a few actors. And you almost feel like you had to restrain yourself in writing it, and you have long relationships with it. You know the tragedy of Chicago. You wrote about Cabrini Green and other places. How did this relationship and this smaller story, but the relationship, how did it affect you, and why did you want to write this book?
There are a lot of ways that I could think about that question. So I've been involved in this community in one way or another for 30 years, and I feel very blessed. I don't know a lot of people who would want me around for three days, let alone 30 years. So it's a pretty special relationship to be able to have people invite you to return. This particular book was started probably a half dozen times, maybe a dozen times, and I kept stopping because I was unable to figure out a way to tell the story. I think we have to put ourselves back into a different time period when the conversation, when the world of big data was overtaking us, and we had a very different way of seeing, a very powerful way of seeing. And so some of the best research on guns and youth and gun violence was by economists who were bringing a new set of tools from behavioral science to big data. And Jens Ludwig at the University of Chicago, for example, just a fantastic researcher who's taught me so much about guns and gun violence. But I study two people. I study a group, a family. I didn't really know how to, you know, think about that. And then accidentally I met a social worker in the neighborhood who I'd known for a long time, Dorothy, called and realized I was struggling. And the funny thing about folks who know you for 30 years is they know you better than yourself. So she said, I think you might have a good conversation with this one gentleman, and he's in the book, and his name is Harpoon. And Harpoon is a gun trader. And she said, he's very knowledgeable about this world, and he might be able to help you. And I said, that's fine, I could use all the help I can get. So I was talking to Harpoon, and Harpoon started tearing up. And it's the first time I met him. And I said, well, can I help you? Is there something wrong? Did I say something wrong? He said, I just found out I'm gonna be a dad. And then I started crying because I just became a dad. And so here I am with this guy who's supposed to be my interview subject, right? He's supposed to sit in this nice little box, and I'm supposed to be asking information about guns and this and that. And meanwhile, we're both just crying about, he's scared to be a dad, I'm scared because I'm a dad. We did this for about 3 months. And then he said, you know, weren't we supposed to be talking about guns or something? I said, oh yeah, we're supposed to. So slowly he started to tell me a little bit about some of the challenges he had. And one of the challenges he had was, what am I going to tell my son when he grows up and I have to tell him how I made money? And so we talk about that a little bit. So I realized, wow, I don't have to be a sociologist to write a book. And it became very liberating. I could just be a dad, or I could be a parent, and I could look at it, and I saw just all of these different aspects of the community, one of which was just the struggle of families to raise children, and in a way that I hadn't, because most of my work was around the people involved in very serious crime or trying to understand why kids join gangs, and it often missed the people that were just doing the struggles that I was doing as a parent. And that helped me to just write a simpler story, but a more challenging one for me, which was just about two kids and what it's like to grow up, and you know, how a small little schoolyard tussle turns into something bigger.
And we won't tell you how it ends because it's really intense. So you wanna read a piece?
Yeah, I'm gonna read I'll do two quick readings and that's it. There are two characters. The first part of the book is getting into trouble, about the two kids who get into trouble, and the second part of the book is about all of the people who help them get out of trouble, or try to anyway. That's the best way to think about this. So I'm gonna read you a little bit from part one and then a little bit from part two. In part one, it really revolves around two kids. One is named Frankie and one is named Marshall, and they're both teenagers living in this neighborhood. This is where the book begins. Frankie Paul sits at the clean white picnic table. His hands are clasped in prayer and his palms are clammy with sweat. His restless feet throw squeaks up from the tile floor. He is only in the prisoner's visitor's room, the prison's visitor's room, excuse me, but it is enough to make him nervous. A guard stares Frankie down. Frankie quiets his feet. Feels a lot like school, he thinks to himself. The room for the guests of inmates is stark and antiseptic, the smell of bleach and linoleum. Only one of the white walls is decorated with a large sign that hangs head high. No shouting, no touching, no eating and drinking, no cell phones. Two other visitors, a Latina woman and her teenage daughter, sit silently at a table 20 feet away. A low-pitched alarm rattles the metal bars that crisscross the window. Frankie looks up to see Willie escorted through a thick steel door by an armed guard. Willie's tattooed neck, arms, and chest bulge through the bluish-gray government-issued jumpsuit. He has been working out. Willie walks over calmly and slides gently into the seat opposite Frankie. He looks relaxed and unbothered, but Frankie knows that his older cousin is not happy. Willie stares back at the teenager who decided to dress up for the visit, a Chicago warm-up suit all white from head to toe and a bright offsetting MJ red hat. Willie does not say anything to his cousin except to nod that he is ready to listen. Frankie starts off with an apology that he has been rehearsing for the past hour. "Wasn't my fault, Willie. I did my best, but we got a problem," Frankie stammers. "Willie, I know you're mad, but I need to explain something to you." Frankie starts to perspire. His speech is halting and he is losing his breath and he struggles to finish a sentence. Then Willie raises his hands and shakes his head. Relieved, Frankie stops talking. The inmate's eyes turn steely and his nose flares, and Willie has decided that today's conversation will now be a monologue. "You shouldn't be here," Willie says softly, "but I do understand why you're here. I mean, I wish you weren't here, but we gotta get past that, right? It is what it is." Frankie sits back and mashes his sweaty palms together. Before leaving for prison, Willie instructed Frankie to stay away from lockup, far away. Specifically, Willie gave orders for Frankie to remain in Chicago. Frankie should only send messages via Calvin, the prison security guard who Willie's gang keeps on retainer. Willie warned Frankie that cops will be checking the visitation logs of new inmates. It's the easiest way to figure out who might be taking over the street drug trade of an incarcerated kingpin. So Frankie was in foster care and left foster care out of the good graces of Willie, who was a drug kingpin in a neighborhood. He calls himself a kingpin. And he took Frankie under his wing, and Frankie would do small chores like getting food for some of the people in Willie's outfit. And eventually Willie was sent to jail and said, "Frankie, you're gonna take over." Frankie had never run anything on the street. He didn't know anything about drugs or guns or anything like that. But now he's put into this situation and he's fraught. He's internally trying to figure out, what are my choices? Either I do this very, very well, or I go back to foster care. And he does not want to go back to foster care. So the book is really about this kid who didn't ask to be put in this situation. And he is now having to make a very, very difficult decision. And we kind of explore that a little bit. And maybe I'll use that just to turn over a little bit to Tenney, who maybe doesn't even know how much of an inspiration he was for me in writing this book, he and his organization, because they are with these children every day in the most dire of circumstances and in wonderful circumstances, experiencing everything. And I've often been curious, because Tenney sees the kind of breadth of the difficult situations that children face, children, youth, young people. I'll just open it up by this was a situation maybe not a lot of people would understand, that historical sense of a young man wanting to please his older cousin. I'm curious to know if you see what circumstances jump out for you that people often don't see, that show very resilient, strategic, agile minds that are trying to figure a way out of where they are.
I mean, you describe. Yeah, I used to tell young people on the East Coast when I worked there that you really are just monopoly pawns on a monopoly board you did not design, right? And this is not the most important conflict. This is not really your choice. And this is not really often your opponent. You were put on a board that was pre-designed, and if you're going to be taken off the board to jail or to your grave, there's going to be new pawns in that game. And in this, you feel so frustrated. To think for ourselves that it is better to him, he's terrified taking this new role, but it is unthinkably better than being back in foster home. System that we have built and we pay for and support. What kind of horror? I visited in prison in Rhode Island three brothers. One committed a homicide, one was accessory, different incident. Third one was in and out for drug. Mom was addicted and they were in foster homes. And I asked one of them, I spent a lot of time visiting them, when things went south for you, I says, We went like three or four foster homes within 2 years. It was the end of us. And the best thing I ever did with a credit card of the Institute in Providence was to wipe out $890 that she owed the court so she can come from Massachusetts and visit her children. That was their request. And because she was addicted, she accumulated some fine. There was warrants for her. So that these are the traps that families are in often. And I understood his motivation, and yet there's a twist. He's not really competent to run the business. And how did you figure that out?
Right, so Frankie is put in this position where he has to figure out how to be a leader. And he's going through leadership school with Willie, who's in jail, and trying to get some kind of divine inspiration. And I won't give away the end, but maybe just touch upon one thing that happens in the beginning, which is he realizes, based on this exchange with what Willie is telling him a little bit later in that passage that I read, Willie tells him, your crew needs to know that you are able to lead them. And the best way to do that is for them to have an enemy. You know, somebody to go after. You need to give them a sense that they are in a wartime situation. And so Frankie leaves that meeting and says, an enemy, that's what I need. I need an enemy. And so he decides he's going to go back into the neighborhood and make an enemy out of another kid. So that's when we bring in Marshall. And I wanted to start in this way because it's one of those, the chessboard or the Monopoly board, I'm sorry, I did the analogy, but he didn't ask for that situation, and now he's pulling another person into his life story who also didn't ask to be placed in that situation. And so I just wanted to show the kind of circumstances that we're not even at a point where there's any weapon, there's nothing really, the kids haven't even met, but from their perspective, it is just so complicated in terms of everything that's going on in their mind about what you should be doing and how you should be living at that particular age. Here I might just make a transition, and I don't know if many people know this, but next year is the 100th anniversary of the naming of the 70 community areas in Chicago. They were officially called community areas. We just call them neighborhoods, I suppose. Although if you're in real estate, I guess you can name any neighborhood you want. But if you think about some of the older names of Grand Boulevard and Hyde Park and Logan Square, these were all created, many of them were created in a large map in 1923 by social scientists. And because they felt as though the thing that was very unique about the American city was that people lived in neighborhoods, and it was the neighborhood that mattered. And if that lore that Chicago has about we don't want nobody, you know, nobody sent, or that it's all these ways of marking stranger and familiar person, that goes back, there's a rich history to it, and it very much impacts the story of violence of young people, because the world for them is that little neighborhood. And one of I found this family and these families when I was working at Facebook, running a safety team that was trying to understand how technology was changing the lives of young people who were caught up in these situations. Our interest was to figure out whether we could help people to stop being bullied and harassed online. And meanwhile, what we discovered is it wasn't just what was happening online. It was even the kinds of violence that was occurring on the street was very fundamentally shaped by the world of social media. And so the double challenge, and here I'm going to pose a question back to Tenny that arises for Frankie and Marshall, is that Twitter and Facebook and Instagram became their public square. That was the space where that conversation was happening. And so as the story unfolds, Marshall has enough of a difficult time when this young man named Frankie decides that he's going to be his enemy. Now he starts facing the challenge of inhabiting a world where there's all of these name calling, all of this conversation circulating on Twitter and Facebook in the community, so that his neighborhood is now a technological neighborhood as well as a real neighborhood. And he's got to navigate those two, because online he's being taunted and pressured to go back after Frankie and show that he's a man and live up to what it means to be a man, et cetera. So from the perspective of kids, that challenge is even more difficult than in earlier years, because they're managing so many more dimensions of input and influence and that are shaping what they do. And I'm curious, Tenny, you and your staff, what is it like to try and intervene and participate in a productive way when you are, it must feel like you're fighting against a technological conversation and a technological set of dynamics, as well as dynamics on the ground. And I'm curious to know how you distort energy and try to be cognizant of where the inputs that lead kids to eventually getting into very difficult situations, where those inputs come from.
It's such a real part of a challenge. We constantly jump on social media and monitor it, and we're always probably behind, and there's only that many people. You and I were dreaming then, and I think in the future there will be outreach workers almost dedicated. We know law enforcement now has dedicated people looking at social media. What if peacemakers had it too? And it's another way to embarrass you, shame you, challenge you. And in a way, it's easier to do than in... So the gun provides a distance that fists didn't. Social media provides another distance, right? So it takes even less courage to initiate that. But ultimately, like all conflicts between nations, between people, between... You can start lobbying the first insult. Then the dynamics is sort of on its own. Just like shooting someone. You can, when people want revenge, mm-hmm. I tell them, all right, you can maybe feel good, you can shoot a target, you can maybe find the person you want, but you can't guarantee if they're coming back and hitting your sister or your mother, other people. So that dynamic, social media accelerates that. The amount of guns accelerates that. So we have, and that creates a different level of fear as well. On a positive note, I would say is that maybe also some of the conflict on social media actually helps avoid some stuff. I mean, I'm really not going to be a very convincing, I'm not even convinced myself, but that you can do it from a distance. Like we are showing our muscles from a distance, but we're really not getting involved in a conflict. So people still are afraid of conflict and still trying to avoid it. And that's where the opening is of the book, actually. I think that's what the book describes. We often write about the conflicts when they erupt and we see them. But all the times that people actually rationalize and reason and stop their conflicts, yeah. Those we don't write about yeah. often. And this book goes that fine line.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes me think of another way of thinking about, in helping people maybe who aren't familiar with daily life in the neighborhood, there's another way that I like to pose this as you talk about social media and distance. You know, imagine some problem or something that happens that causes, maybe it doesn't have to be major distress, just minor disagreement or conflict or, you know, something you have to attend to. I immediately go to my 7-year-old and 10-year-old who won't pick up their clothes. Okay, that occurs a lot of time. I'm not saying that equates with gun violence. But I want you to think of something that happens a lot that you have to attend to on a repeated basis, and how you manage the stress and how you get into a routine and how you do it without even thinking about it and how you accept that it's part of your life and you manage it and it's a source of stress, but you manage it and so on and so on and so forth. Now, the reason I do that is because if I were to just tell you this statistic without telling you that first part of it, it would be difficult for you to get in that headspace. And the statistic is that in the month that this story takes place, if you were to look at the police department's data, which is available on the CLEAR data set online, there are 57 recorded incidents of a use of gun in the neighborhood in the act of committing a crime. So let's just say there are 57 incidents of some kind of gun violence in just 1 month. And that's just what the police were able to record. So now, go back to what I said before about how you get into a script. You know how you're going to deal with this thing that happens, or this the range of things that's going to happen. You'll adjust, you'll make adjustments, you'll sometimes it'll make you more upset, less upset. And imagine you have to deal with 57 incidents of gun violence in your neighborhood. This is just one particular month. It's a month of September. It's not even the summer. So how would you adjust? What's the first thing that comes to mind? I'd move out. So maybe you would leave. Now I'm going to put you in the situation of being in a low-income neighborhood. It's not really an option. You'd lose all your social networks. Or as a friend of mine said, if I leave the fishbowl, and I can't leave the fishbowl because then I'll die. So this is where I have to stay. So you go on like this and you start to see that people have an extraordinarily creative, agile way of responding to a situation in which they're living with dozens and dozens of incidents all of the time. And for a young person, not only are they having to respond by knowing how to read the cues and the signs, but then they're also trying to think about their future. And they're trying to think about what it means to be an American, or what it means to have a career, or what it means to do anything that's future-oriented. And hence the title, The Tomorrow Game, is that they're constantly playing a game of trying to recreate a future when everything on a daily level is taking that future away from them or making it much more fraught. And so my question I'm curious for Tenny is, how does this, the level of saturation of just the ever presence of that 57 incidents, how does that change the kind of work that you would do? If you work with community residents, you have to deal with being in there. So how does it change what you think of as a problem or a solution or an approach, knowing that there's another one coming right after it?
You have to be very dogged in this work. Change is very incremental. In this city, it will take 10 to 15 years, and you don't see it immediately. And you got to pay attention to those details. I think reading this book, I felt, my team works in Austin and West Garfield, back of the yard in Brighton Park, that this beginning of this incident wouldn't even register on my team's register. And that's tragic, because we need to get to that. But we are so busy with real multiple victims. We had a participant and a daughter of a supervisor, and the supervisor was there, shot this weekend on Monroe Street in West Garfield. Mm-hmm. The next day, a victim advocate was shot. He's going tomorrow through another operation. At that level of intensity of conflict, I was reading this, and I was like, as I'm getting through the book, with the first half, I'm like, this wouldn't even be something we work on very often, and we should. We want to get to that. But we almost have, you reviewed once a book that I love, Jill Yovey, on the post-homicides, a detective in LA, what makes the difference in the details and doggedness. This book is actually how you can be that detective and that worker before. And I would like us to get to that place. But at the moment, what we're dealing with is Chicago, and we'll get there. We're actually dealing with already people who are already in the system, in the networks of violence. And that's something I want to really reflect on and think, how do we get, mm-hmm. how do we calm down our work, that we pay attention to things when they're still smaller and mm-hmm. they're still just budding. Mm-hmm. But we have too many open conflicts already full-fledged.
Yeah. I'm going to shift now to the part two of it, and then we'll move to a broader conversation. There's a path, as a segue, there's a pastor, Pastor Jesse, who kindly let me observe his work. He has something called the Book of Names that he keeps, which is an open ledger. And you can only make it in the Book of Names if you are a young person and there's a gun involved and you, there's been a shooting, there's, you know, you're at the verge of, there's a retaliation, you're in harm's way. And so one of the things he has is another sheet of paper of all of these other people who he has to decide, they're not so much in harm's way that they're gonna be for me, hopefully somebody else will take care of them. So that's the, that must be an extraordinarily difficult thing to do, to be able to triage constantly and to know that compassion is limited. So I really feel for you and your team. It's a, must be a very, very difficult thing to do. And I want to talk a little bit more about that in just the couple of minutes here before we move to Q&A. And that is to think about and reflect, and perhaps in Chicago, I these numbers change constantly. I hear 10, I hear 15, I hear 20s. It's a very small percentage of the 70 community areas I was talking about host something like 80 to 90% of all of the gun violence in the city. So it's concentrated in a number of neighborhoods. I would just be curious for you all, as I read this passage, to think a little bit about what happens to you when something becomes a community incident. What is that thing that that clicks for you immediately? Who do you call? What do you do? What are your resources? Where's the place of safety? Where's the place of threat? What do you think about first? What's the thing that you do when there are situations that arise? And I'd just like you to have that in mind as I read you this passage. This is about a young man named Harpoon, who I was telling you about, that I met when he realized he was going to be a father. And it's just a little bit of his background. Harpoon. This is the nickname Jeremiah Harrison acquired as an 8-year-old. It happened quickly 20 years ago. His uncle watched the young nephew sit attentively in the living room, listening to an older sister reading a story about hunting whales. Young Harrison pranced around the room pretending to be a whaler. He shouted at his family, 16 people living cramped in a 2-story bungalow, "I'm gonna head out to the ocean and kill that whale." Uncle Terrence laughed and applauded his nephew's determination. "You do that, Harpoon, and don't ever come back to this shithole." Harpoon, the name stuck. It is the street name of one of Chicago's most successful gun dealers, who is also Missy Bateson's boss, another person of his crew. Missy is. 20 years later, Harpoon is standing patiently at the northeast corner of Holden Park, waiting for Missy and the rest of the team to arrive. He warms his hands with a cup of tea, and nearby, 4 middle-aged men play pickup basketball while a band of homeless men rub their hands over a fire in a metal barrel. A merciless lakeshore wind swirls the leaves and shakes the branches in the surrounding oaks. The ducks head for cover under the bramble and tall grass shoots, and Harpoon tears off pieces of dry white bread to bring them back. Midweek is a slow time in the gun trade. Customers will not be thinking about their weekend needs for at least another 24 hours. It is the perfect timing for a team meeting. Harpoon has worked diligently to put together the right mix of talent. Sally looks out for cops. Junie hires local residents part-time for extra security. Lena is the wise money manager. Felicity launders cash by striking deals with local businesses. And Missy recruits all hired contractors and supervises out-of-town purchasing. Everyone is experienced at their craft. There is one job that is shared by the entire team, handling customers. A request to purchase a weapon is always presents risks. The customer may appear to be innocent, just another human seeking protection, but the crew must look out for undercover cops and moles from an enemy crew intent on stealing their cash and weapons. This creates an all-hands-on-deck approach. One person will introduce a new potential customer, but everyone is responsible for vetting the inquiry. It's at the end of September, and Harpoon's team is busy recovering from the frenzied pace of the summer. Autumn gun sales are not colored by ever-present summer conflict. When September rolls around, the street rhythms settle a bit. Tempers still flare, but across the neighborhood, children and families fall into patterns with more of their lives indoors and apart from each other. The antagonisms will be distinct, like cliquish schoolyard fights that turn serious and drawn-out gang fights that spread out over the course of an entire winter. And for Harpoon's team, autumn is a chance to reflect. They used the time to stock up on inventory and to address personal and family matters that had to be ignored during the hot summer months. Invariably, this means a time to consider whether the risks of gun trading are worth the rewards. And we pick this up here where this young man is just found out that he is going to be a father, and he's starting to rethink or what it means to be in this position of managing this team that deals on average between 10 and 20 guns a month in the neighborhood. Never more because it'll alert the cops, never less because it is not enough to make money. So it's always in that zone that he's trying to strike. And he's trying to think about the fact, and he's thinking about the fact that he inherited this business from his uncle, who inherited this business from his uncle. So it's a family business, and giving up that family business would mean shame in front of his family, but it would also mean perhaps having a different person, getting his son out of that family business as well. And the rest of the book is really about the cast of characters, a police officer who works off the books, a pastor, and an ecosystem of people that come out to help Harpoon, to help Marshall and Frankie, and people that we may not often, if we do see them, we often don't recognize their value. It's difficult to give them a grant, right? It's difficult to elevate them and formalize them because their work is so informal. It's difficult to bring them into a system, and yet they are the sinews and fibers that make a community tick. And I wanted to write about that part of this community because so often our understanding of what happens in a period of gun violence ends with the incident, begins again with the media exposure, and then we are kind of held and transfixed by a very particular kind of media representation of what it means. It's not that it's bad or good, it's just you're glued to the TV, you're glued to the radio, and that's a very particular kind of narrative. It's one way of seeing, and I just wanted to offer another way of seeing a different group of people coming together. And just to throw this back on Tenney in the couple minutes that we have, I'm curious to know, where is that kind of invisibility for you? Where is the thing that is not seen? Maybe the voice that is not heard, the thing that we don't often recognize, and not that I'm looking for a magic solution or that you would even think that there would be if we did hear it, but just in the interest of opening up the conversation and the aperture a little bit, what often strikes you as things that you're seeing and your team is seeing, but it's so difficult to accept or to recognize it from outside?
So I'm in a peculiar position, right? I'm an immigrant from another country. I was a soldier. I come from really bad DNA, Israeli, Serbian. Lost grandparents to the Holocaust. And obviously thought a lot as a kid about the ghetto, how very quickly in the ghetto people had to adjust and do things against their own people. And then I come to a country and I also have instincts of a middle class person. Like, I wanted to get really angry at the gun dealers. I mean, the conversations you and I often had is, why is law enforcement, why is the country, if we confiscate 13,000 guns in Chicago, why don't we get people who sell them the guns? Let them be afraid, right? So we go back to fist. So there's a lot of, I think often for me, moments of insights, but the passion intervenes, and this is sort of a calming, quieter little picture, which is so important to portray. So I feel often, I belong in a way to the majority society, but I spend really my time in America, the 30 plus year, mainly in African American communities, and that's why I feel my allegiances as an ally. And I often feel when the certain behaviors happen that the majority is judging. Mm. And I'm in my head as I'm driving from the hospital back, I'm frustrated, I'm upset that people go through that pain. And I'm trying to explain to the rest of society why people do that. Because to the majority of society, this is unexplainable. Why would you send guns to people in your community? But to me, I remember of the ghetto, in Warsaw ghetto, where people have smuggled, how certain Jews had to decide which Jews will be tomorrow going to the to be eliminated. You make choices when you are really contained. And it's pretty dramatic what I'm saying, and I never compare disasters. But the pressure cooker, I would wish our country would see more and empathize more. And it's of our own doing. And it is very hard to convey that. And I think you took a very, I really admire that. I will never be able to be so calm as to observe and put on paper how the dynamics, you know, and it's not just morality question or morality tale. People also have to survive in life. That's, morality is one track of your brain. The other one is I gotta eat and I gotta do things. Mm-hmm. And I play in rules that I haven't always reflected, but I have moments of reflection. For them, I was thinking of the Bible song, for every time there's a season, right? Mm-hmm. September is a time of reflection for gun dealers, maybe to leave the business.
It's very true, yeah. It's one of the reasons I asked you before is who would you call and why, and what is instinctive in your neighborhood? I live in a very small town, and so, you know, there's a police detective who's the assistant coach on my little league team, and I have a lot of trust in Officer Frank, and I know that there's a couple of neighbors, and I know that there's, you know, I have my security blanket, and for, in this neighborhood, Harpoon is a very instrumental member of the security blanket, and it is the first person that the police officer and the pastor go to after an incident to start a intervention. And to interrupt and to figure out how to calm the situation. And I just want you to think about why Harpoon, and if we want, we can talk about it, but and that's how an ecosystem can just change the fact that an enemy, quote unquote, can be an ally. And so the idea that there are good people or bad people, and if we could just get, you know, rid of the bad people, then we'd have the good people in the neighborhood. You know, it's a much more challenging situation when people are your neighbor's children, your own children, your friends, etc., people that you've known their parents, etc. It's a different kind of dynamic.
Well, I want to thank you both for that wonderful, thought-provoking discussion. Thank you all for coming, and please join me in thanking our guests tonight.
Thank you, Tenny, and thank you for coming tonight. Have a safe journey home.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AWM Author Talks podcast. Next week, acclaimed writers Maxine Hong Kingston and Viet Thong Nguyen discuss Kingston's writing legacy in light of the new collection of Kingston's work from the Library of America, edited by Nguyen. This conversation was recorded live for the American Writers Festival. Now go, be inspired, and find the mind of a writer in yourself.